Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the universal account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. With one account for over 50 currencies, who exactly is Wise made for? It's made for Austrians in Australia, South Africans in Sweden. It's made for New Delhi, New York, and even regular York. When you use Wise to manage your money across borders, you always get the mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. Join 13 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you at wise.com/world.
Russia continues to lose more ground in Ukraine, bringing worries about what Vladimir Putin might do about those losses.
He's a guy who, I think, consistently has doubled down in dealing with things. He doesn't back down. He pushes forward and tries to get his way.
Also ahead, why Denmark is losing some princes and a princess.
The queen wants to modernize the monarchy.
Denmark's queen is following a trend across Europe, fewer royals in a bid for more public support. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Plus, Mediterranean mussels from Spain are being wiped out by unusually warm waters. This mussel farmer says she'd reserved an entire dock for tastings, but all the mussels on her lines have died. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler, in for Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. The war in Ukraine seems to be edging closer to a dangerous tipping point. Ukrainian troops have pushed Russian soldiers out of the city of Lyman, a key logistics hub in the northeast of the country. Meanwhile, thousands of mobilized Russian troops are reportedly being sent home, deemed unfit for military duty. Anxieties are especially high after a key ally of President Vladimir Putin called for the use of a low-yield nuclear weapon in Ukraine. Even some of the Russian leader's closest advisors don't know what Putin is thinking. That's according to someone who spent plenty of time in the room with Putin himself, former U.S. ambassador to Russia John Teft.
On a given day, I'm not sure who knows exactly what Vladimir Putin is thinking. And I think those of us in the West need to be careful and humble in our estimates of the man, because we just don't have the kind of access or the understanding of his current mindset at this point.
Teft says Putin has backed himself into a corner in Ukraine.
This is a man who learned life in the streets of Leningrad when he was growing up, a very tough upbringing. And he's a guy who, I think, consistently has doubled down in dealing with things. He doesn't back down. He pushes forward and tries to get his way. And I think what we've had in Ukraine is a strategic mistake that he made launching the invasion in the beginning, a strategic mistake of the first order. But he seems to be making additional mistakes now, hoping that he can rectify the situation and still achieve his dream of taking control of all of Ukraine.
So let's talk about the thing overshadowing all of this, nukes. Chechen leader Ramzan Kadyrov, a close Putin ally, generated a lot of headlines this week when he called for the use of a low-yield nuclear weapon. Russian leaders try to counter that sort of talk. Do you see this nuclear threat as rising right now?
Putin looks at this and sees the impact that it has, certainly in Western media. But I've talked to some other experts, and most of them right now, the ones that I listen to, don't think that use of nuclear weapons is any time imminent, that he's in fact, but the bringing in more troops, conscripting more people in this partial mobilization, as he calls it, that this signifies an attempt to keep going and press ahead inside the war. Now, the other thing is, I think Putin still hasn't given up on the idea of somehow increasing opposition to Western support for the war, primarily in Europe, but I think also perhaps even in the United States. He hasn't been very successful in that, and maybe he calculates that brandishing this idea of possible tactical nuclear weapons use on the battlefield will scare people and try to do that.
So this weekend, former CIA director and retired Army General David Petraeus told ABC News that the U.S. would destroy Russia's troops if Putin uses nuclear weapons in Ukraine. Is this what U.S. officials, those currently in office, are trying to convey to the Kremlin?
Part of the whole reason for this war, you'll remember, was Putin's miscalculation, not just of what was happening inside of Ukraine, and not just his dream of controlling it, but his misreading of the West from the very beginning. And I think it's important that we continue to send very clear signals about what the cost of this would be. I listened to my friend Bill Burns the other day, and he was saying how carefully they're monitoring situation, including movements of critical weapons systems that might give some indication of what was happening. So it seems to me they're doing about all that you can do at this point, at least from my perspective outside of government.
Do you see any off-ramps or opportunities for conversations with Russian officials?
Now, I think that the administration has tried very hard to signal that it's willing to countenance negotiations. But I have to say right now, I don't see that Putin is in any mood to actually engage in any kind of negotiations. And if there were to be some, I suspect he would try to find a way to just cut a deal that would continue to hold a lot of Ukrainian territory. And the Ukrainians have made it clear they're not going to stand for that. So I think we need to keep open the possibility of talks, but I don't see right now that there's any real prospect in the immediate future for these. I would just say I think Putin is calculating of trying to get through the winter because that'll probably minimize some of the fighting, but it will also allow him to put greater pressure on Europe, particularly in terms of energy supply, and to see whether that changes the political equation, the political support for Ukraine inside of Europe.
You mentioned the winter. I know you're a diplomat and not a military general, but how do you see colder temperatures, energy security playing into the fighting this winter?
Obviously, the Europeans have been doing everything they can to stockpile energy. We would all hope that this winter is not going to be a very cold one in Europe. I'm not sure that Putin really has gotten it right on this point, because what I hear, not just from governments, but I've had some friends who've just come back from Europe, from Britain, from Germany, and they keep telling me that the support for Ukraine at the grassroots level is still very, very strong, just as it is here in our country. People identify with Ukraine fighting against this repressive power that's trying to just take over their country. And people understand that on not just an intellectual level, but I think an emotional level. But I think we shouldn't overestimate the divisions inside of Russia. And we should always remember that Putin has spent 20 years making sure that he is at the top and that he is unchallenged at this point. There's never guarantees, of course, but I think he's still very much in charge and calling the shots, literally and figuratively.
Finally, what are you keeping an eye on going forward to understand where this is headed?
Well, I was listening this morning to a colleague who said that he'd recently been in Ukraine and had been out to the front lines. And he said in his week or so of going around, he didn't hear a single person in military or private say, we need to stop this war. People seem to be united behind this effort to try to push the Russians out. And so I think that's a key one. The other part is I try to watch as carefully as I can at this point the public attitudes inside of Russia. Clearly, the mobilization has caused divisions at the top, and it's obviously hit home for a lot of people, just judging from the number of Russian young men and who have left the country. But, you know, what about the average person who has been a supporter of Putin for many years? He sees all of the people who have been killed, all of the soldiers who have been brought home and buried. When are they going to start asking, has this been worth it? What are we achieving with all of this horrible loss of life? Are we really the great Russian power, which is what our president said he wanted to achieve? I try to watch that as carefully as I can, but it's very hard, especially since many of the media who followed this very carefully in the past, many of the people responsible have left the country now, and we don't get the kinds of information that we used to.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Russia John Teft also served as U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Georgia, and Lithuania. He's now a senior fellow at the Rand Corporation. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
In Brazil, there was a surprise result in yesterday's presidential election. Former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva was expected to be the big winner, even if he didn't win outright to avoid another round of voting. But yesterday's result shows incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro just a handful of points behind Lula. And that means a few more weeks of intense campaigning. From Sao Paulo, Michael Fox has the story.
The mood outside the hotel where Lula was watching the results roll in was on fire as the former president passed Bolsonaro in the vote count and took the lead. But it went from ecstatic to subdued within an hour as it became increasingly clear that this election was going to be much tighter than expected. Wilson Gomes is a Lula supporter who was outside as the news came in.
Esperava, a gente acompanha as pesquisas e não esperava que fosse uma diferença tão.
We've been following the polls, he told me, and we weren't expecting that Bolsonaro would receive such expressive support as Lula. 48% for Lula, 43% for Bolsonaro. For Lula supporters, victory felt like defeat. In a speech after the ballots were counted, Lula responded to people's fears.
E quero dizer para vocês que nós vamos ganhar essas eleições.
Folks, we are going to win these elections, he said. This is just a little extension.
Isso para nós é apenas uma prorrogação.
Lula told the crowd that he would hit the ground running today.
O resultado 2018, primeiro turno, nós...
Bolsonaro also spoke to supporters in Brasília last night, and he said he'd be doubling down on several key states in southeastern Brazil where he hadn't met expectations. There are many theories about why pollsters got the election so wrong amid Bolsonaro's apparent surge. But one thing is clear. Lula clocked in right about where he'd been trending for weeks. Bolsonaro's added support seemed to come from voters who decided to defect from the more centrist third-party candidates. Regardless, if the political climate was intense before, now experts say it's going on overdrive. Mauricio Santoro is a political scientist at Rio de Janeiro State University.
And these results will give Bolsonaro more enthusiasm to reinforce his discourse that his supporters cannot trust the polls, and it will also increase the risk of political violence in the campaign.
The country is polarized. I saw this speaking with voters yesterday in Sao Paulo. People like Berenice Vieira. I met her shortly after she arrived to the voting center with her husband and teenage son. They wore matching Brazilian soccer jerseys, the colors of the Brazilian flag, yellow and green, Bolsonaro's colors. This election is really important, she said. We're defending our country because there is one candidate that defends Brazil, that defends our homeland and family, and the other candidate that doesn't.
Da maioria do que a gente viu em mobilização.
Almost every Bolsonaro supporter I spoke with, like this taxi driver, said they were afraid that if elected, Lula would sink the country into a quagmire of corruption and so-called socialism, rolling back their freedoms. On the flip side, Lula supporters said they were fighting for nothing less than the country's democracy, trying to stop the rising authoritarianism, the violence, the racism, the continuous attacks on state institutions, social rights, indigenous communities, the Amazon. And while the battle for the presidency has captured headlines, the fight for Congress has been just as acute, and it will have a profound impact on these very issues going forward. See, there were more than 1,500 state and federal congressional seats up for grabs, over 2 dozen senators and governors. An unprecedented number of indigenous, black, and campesino candidates ran for office, and some of them won. Sonia Guarajajara, the leader of the country's largest indigenous organization. She was elected to Congress, as was the first black trans woman, Erika Hilton. 6 of the landless workers movement candidates won state and federal congressional seats. João Paulo Rodrigues is a leader of the landless workers movement. He said, this was a hard election, but we were politically victorious even if we didn't have all the electoral wins that we needed. But Bolsonaro and his allies, they won big. The president's Liberal Party now has the largest bloc in Congress, with nearly 100 congressional representatives. Several former members of Bolsonaro's government are also on their way to Brasília. Here's Mauricio Santoro.
Bolsonaro's former ministers of agriculture, science, human rights, justice, environment, health, and his vice president were all elected to Congress. So it will be a very conservative legislative power, especially the Senate, the upper house. And if Lula is elected president, it will be a challenge for him.
And that is also what the next few weeks will be, a challenge. Lula and Bolsonaro will be pulling out all the stops. If there is one silver lining for Lula supporters, it is this. UCLA historian Brian Pitts.
Had Lula won by a large margin in the first round, had he won outright and avoided the need for a second round, then it would have been absolutely guaranteed that Bolsonaro would have contested the results. Completely without evidence, but he would have contested it all the same and had the potential to gain support from some of the military or the military police.
With a close election, Pitts says, it's harder for Bolsonaro to contest the results. The second round election is on October 30th. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Sao Paulo.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. On Saturday, a soccer game in Indonesia turned tragic. A stampede at a stadium in East Java ended with more than 125 people dead and hundreds more injured. Police fired tear gas into the crowd after some fans flooded onto the field, sparking a rush for the exits. Indonesia's president has promised to thoroughly investigate what went wrong. The World's Patrick Wynn joins us with the latest. Patrick, what was the sequence of events that led to police firing tear gas in the first place?
This particular match in Indonesia happened in a large city called Malang. The match was between two Indonesian teams. The home team lost 3-2, and fans mobbed the field. And so riot police came out firing tear gas to get the fans off the field, with some canisters landing in the seating area. And footage of the beginning of the stampede was recorded and uploaded to social media. So you can hear those little pops there. That's the tear gas. And, you know, anyone who's been around tear gas knows it makes you flee in a blind panic. And that's exactly what happened. People were fleeing. There were not enough exits at the stadium. And then they trampled each other trying to get out.
So has there been any blame placed yet for this loss of life?
Definitely. Police at this point are taking most of the blame. FIFA, the governing body of all football, does have a rule against firing tear gas in stadiums. They broke that rule. The regional police chief did say there was anarchy on the field. We had no choice, but human rights groups are pressing for a full independent investigation of the police and not just an internal review. Another factor is the stadium was really packed out. Indonesia is coming out of COVID restrictions. Football is super popular there, and the stadium has seating for 38,000, but it sold tickets for 42,000. So that's potentially 4,000 people over capacity. That's something else that will also probably be reviewed in any investigation. And then, of course, you have the inciting event, angry fans. They are blamed for rushing the field and starting this whole thing off for the first place.
So potentially some changes to come. Last question, Patrick. Do soccer games in Indonesia get this out of control frequently? I mean, why were the riot police with tear gas there to begin with?
Yeah, over the last 30 years, more than 70 Indonesians have died in brawls at stadiums. I have to say the average football fan in Indonesia is passionate, but not over the top. But then, as in many countries, you have football clubs that are pretty hardcore and have these rivalries with other clubs. And at the most intense level, they even train in martial arts so they can win these fights. So that is why you have riot police at the games in the first place. The angry fans who rushed the field, the first ones to hit the field, were yelling at players and threatening them. And that's what caused the police to come out. And then more fans came out and more police came out, and it escalated from there. So moving forward, it does appear the government will come up with some way to intervene and install some new rules or measures to prevent a repeat of this incident. But I do think Indonesian football will go on. I mean, it really is a way of life for many people in Indonesia, most of whom might yell and scream and get passionate, but, you know, never take it too far.
Patrick Wynn covers Southeast Asia for us from Bangkok. Patrick, thanks for filling us in.
Thanks, Carolyn.
In Spain, local mussels are a summer favorite, often served steamed in a simple broth to let the mussels shine. But this year's Mediterranean harvest was nearly wiped out by unusually warm waters. And the entire crop of baby mussels seeded for next year's harvest also died. Most Mediterranean mussels are grown in the Ebro Delta in Spain's northeast. As Jerry Haddon reports, fishmongers there are now facing ruin.
In a typical mussel joint, waiters place rubber buckets on the floor around your table. It's where you chuck the empty shells. This is an offshore mussel farm called Avi Agusti. It's a wooden hut held up by pilings. At outdoor tables, you can sample the local haul, steamed and as fresh as they come, usually. This year, says owner Jonah Gomez, the mussels were trucked in from Italy. We'd reserved this entire mussel dock for these tourist tastings, she says, but all the mussels on our 75 lines have died. Jonah's son Eric pulls up one of the thick ropes dangling from the dock into the 10-foot-deep water. It's caked with the mollusks. Each was hand-glued to the line a year ago. They look fine, but... How's this batch, I ask? All dead, says Eric, due to the water temperature. This summer's heat was uncommon, says Jonah. The sea is always warmer in August, but once it gets above 82 degrees, the mussels die, she says. Spain had a record 42 days of water temperatures over that 82-degree line. It was an unprecedented underwater heat wave. It climbed past 86 degrees, then all the way to 90, Jonah says. Not the air temperature, but the water. This, she says, is not acceptable. Unacceptable, but also uncontrollable. Seawater is influenced by air temperature, among other things. And in Spain this summer, it was hot. Day after day, week after week, that heat warmed the sea. Spain does produce mussels in other regions, but Delta mussels are cherished for their small size and unique flavor, a flavor they get from the brackish waters where the Ebro River spills into the Mediterranean. Mussel lovers really love them. That's become a problem for restaurants like Pepe's Bar, a nearby beachside spot. In the kitchen, a cook watches over mussels steaming in a cauldron. But like at Avi Agusti's, these are also imported from Greece. Waitress Sandra Teayasco says diners will often ask her whether her mussels are from the Delta. She says when you tell them the Delta mussels are finished, many customers say, forget it. At Barcelona's iconic Boqueria market, tourists and locals rub shoulders shuffling past the dozens of food stands. Lluïsa Ripoll owns one of them. She's a fifth-generation fishmonger. These days, she has only Atlantic mussels on ice. They're bigger and saltier than their Mediterranean cousins and delicious in their own way, she says. But she worries about the loss of biodiversity and how that will affect sales. She says if there are no Delta mussels, the price of other mussels go up due to supply and demand. It's a problem for us no longer being able to offer them, she says. Spain has lost roughly 8 million pounds of Mediterranean mussels this season, but Ripoll's family has survived this long by adapting. Just a couple of years back, she says, she never dreamed customers would buy seafood online. It's now a big part of her business, she says, and she's confident she'll make it through the mussel shortage. That's because Ripoll sells all sorts of fish and seafood. For the Gomez family, down in the Ebro Delta, the outlook is grimmer. You just lose your entire investment like that, says Jonah, tossing her lifeless mussel line back in the water. Even the imported ones die, she says. So now we have to go back and import again and hope that in October that the water temperature drops enough. But you never know, she says. We're forever vulnerable to these conditions. Growers here worry that with climate change, this summer's heat wave could be the new normal. The only solution they see, moving their docks further out to sea, into deeper, cooler, and saltier waters. Even if that alters the flavor of their mussels, they say, it'd be better than having none at all. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon on the Ebro Delta in Spain.
You're listening to The World. This sound is a hallmark of summer in Canada and the northern U.S. But the call of the common loon may become less common in parts of its territory.
I was stunned and still am kind of stunned and shocked because you don't expect your study animal to suddenly begin to vanish.
Now, a cross-border collaboration is looking for answers. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More unrest in Iran today. Police arrested hundreds of people, mostly students, protesting on a university campus in Tehran. Iranians have been demonstrating since the death of Mahsa Amini, a young woman who died in police custody after she was accused of wearing the hijab incorrectly. Today, Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, also spoke for the first time since the demonstration began a couple of weeks ago. He called the protests a foreign plot to destabilize Iran. For more on all of this, we turn to Borzu Daragahi. He's a correspondent with The Independent and a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. Borzu, what can you tell us about this standoff today in Tehran between students and security forces?
Well, the standoff has been going on for a couple days now. So as soon as classes got back, they were all online for a week or so, pretty much from like the moment they came back to campus on Saturday, the beginning of the Iranian work week. It's been protest after protest, slogans, etc. Now, at one university, it's called Sharif University, there was a confrontation between the students and the Basiji pro-government militias that were there, some of them perhaps also students at the campus. That confrontation escalated, and the Basijis, armed with knives and clubs, perhaps other weapons, besieged the protesting students. Uniformed security forces arrived. There are allegations that they stormed the dormitories where the students were sleeping. Students were arrested. Many others were injured, and so on.
And how did this specific university become the flashpoint between protesters and security forces?
I'm not sure why it became this one. It could have just been a coincidence. Something happened there. But it must be said that, you know, as the elite of the country who tend to be able to go out of the country once they graduate, they must foster a lot of resentment among the rank and file of the pro-government militias, the very powerful Basijis that are under the Revolutionary Guard.
We've been talking about the role of students here. Are the protests in Iran against compulsory headscarf wearing a generational issue?
No, I don't think so at all. I think that far more women of older age remember the time when the headscarf wasn't compulsory are against it. It's just that they don't think it's worth it. You know, they don't think it's worth it to go out in the streets and protest. They feel like they've been out in the streets and protested in 1979 and they got something worse. And so what you hear from the young people when you ask them, why aren't you convincing your elders to come out into the streets? What they're told by their elders is that, like, look, it's not worth it. You really want a good life. You better move abroad.
Iran's government has yet to address the grievances of these protesters. Does it look like the movement is going to maintain its steam in the coming weeks?
I would say that movements like this that are basically without a leader, without a clear agenda, other than, you know, the downfall of the regime, they tend not to go very far in a system as oppressive and securitized as Iran's. The supreme leader today made a speech. He basically said, yeah, it was terrible that this woman died. We're investigating it. But that's no reason to go out and protest in the way that people have been protesting. And that obviously, because the people are not accepting the government's regrets and its vow to investigate, then it must be a foreign plot that is causing these people to protest. He blamed specifically the United States and Israel. He was suggesting that through foreign channels, international satellite channels, they were manipulating the Iranian people. His adjutants have come out publicly and said that this is part of a psychological operation against Iran by the West, meant to weaken the country because of its great accomplishments.
Borzu Daragahi is a correspondent with The Independent and a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. He joined us from Paris. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yesterday, Bosnian voters went to the polls. The election had been clouded by ethnic tensions, but that was overshadowed by changes to the country's constitution forced through by Bosnia's unelected high representative. John Last reports.
Supporters took to the streets with flares and instruments late last night to celebrate the defeat of the Russian-backed Serb separatist Milorad Dodik in Bosnia's election. But they celebrated too soon. This morning, he awoke to a strong lead in the vote, and it's likely that he'll hold on to power. Dodik's victory was just one of the surprise wins for Bosnia's ethnic nationalists last night, though their biggest victory didn't exactly come via the ballot box.
Too much time has been lost.
Last night's democratic exercise was overshadowed when Bosnia's internationally appointed High Representative, Christian Schmidt, took to the airwaves to announce expansive changes to the Bosnian constitution. As High Representative, Schmidt has broad powers to unilaterally enact and veto laws, powers granted to help maintain the delicate balance between the country's three main ethnic groups, Serbs, Bosniaks, and Croats. As polls closed, Schmidt announced a series of reforms, largely to the benefit of Bosnia's Croat ethnic nationalists.
You will see a huge deal of outrage that kind of Bosnia has been taken one step backwards.
Majda Ruga is a senior policy fellow with the European Council on Foreign Relations. She says Schmidt's changes were part of a grand bargain with the Nationalist Party to ensure that the next government will actually have a chance to function. After the last election in 2018, Croat nationalists paralyzed the government by blocking the appointment of ministers and judges. With the changes, Schmidt removed that power, but in exchange, effectively guaranteed the party more seats.
By that, it made them kind of an inevitable component of all future federation governments.
On the upside, that means Bosnia will likely have a more functional government, one that can tackle looming crises in the economy. But not everyone is pleased with the outcome. Anan Čeramagić is a senior analyst for the European Stability Initiative, a Berlin-based think tank.
I think these elections should have been a celebration of a democracy in Bosnia and Herzegovina.
Čeramagić says last night's elections were especially competitive and encouragingly diverse, a sign, he says, that Bosnia's democracy is working. But the High Representative's declaration, he says, overshadowed that development, imposing ethnic divisions once again with little consideration for the will of the voter.
The fight in Bosnia and Herzegovina now is not who has how many seats in the parliament and who's going to be in the government, etc. It's who has the ear of Christian Schmidt.
For now, the dust is still settling on last night's vote. It's not yet clear who exactly will make up the next government. But Schmidt's intervention will ensure nationalists have a voice, for better or for worse. For The World, I'm John Last.
When Russian President Vladimir Putin announced the call-up of 300,000 more troops last month, an exodus of young Russian men began. Many fled to the border with Georgia. The line of cars there has stretched for more than 5 miles, and about 10,000 Russians seek entry every day. That's according to Georgia's interior minister. Inside Georgia, groups of protesters have let Russians know they are not welcome. Politician Giga Lemonjava is among them.
We believe that such kind of migration from Russia poses an imminent threat to Georgia's national security, Georgia's economy, and stability in general.
Part of this standoff has to do with language. Patrick Cox reports from the Georgian capital, Tbilisi.
Georgia has played host to Russian expats for years, but it was only after Russia invaded Ukraine that the big influx began. That was when some Georgians started getting irritated, and people on all sides began taking things to extremes. At the popular Dedaina bar on the banks of Tbilisi's River Mtvari, manager Tato Londorize says Russian customers have become a problem.
They always start talking in Russian. They don't act like normal people inside of the bar where they get drunk. I remember there was several person who was drinking shots, and after they finished their shots, they just broke the glasses, all the glasses.
It happened time and again throughout the summer, Londorize says. And Georgian regulars stopped showing up. So the bar's owners came up with a solution, a series of statements that Russians had to download on their phones and sign off on before they'd be admitted.
The first one says, "I didn't vote for Putin, he's a dictator. I don't support Russian aggression towards Ukraine."
This is my interpreter, Masho Lomashvili. Russian customers must also agree that Russia illegally occupies 20% of Georgia and that 1 in 12 Georgians have become refugees as a result. And they must agree to this statement that quotes a Ukrainian border guard's now famous words.
I like the phrase, "Russian warship, go f*** yourself."
Not surprisingly, Russians don't go to the bar anymore. They may privately agree with the statements, but they get the message. Russians of all stripes experience this kind of hostility. Lola Svanidze has lived in Georgia for longer than most Russians. For 4 years, she has a Georgian father. But she grew up in Russia and doesn't speak Georgian, which is a difficult language for Russians to learn. When she and her friends speak Russian in public, she says Georgians, especially people older than 40, make their feelings known in ways that I can't repeat here.
Как бы да, неприятно грузинам, что на них напали русские, но грузины должны понимать, что
the main problem is people not being able to separate the Russian government from the Russian people. Like, I understand if you have aggression towards people who sit in Russia right now and support this whole thing, but for this certain group, the aggression is unnecessary.
Georgians have good reason to view Russians with suspicion. There's the war in 2008 when the Russian army entered Georgia and occupied a part of the country which they still hold. Before that, Georgia was a largely unwilling member of the Russian and Soviet empires. In the 1970s, Moscow even tried to outlaw the Georgian language. It didn't pan out. Georgia has been independent for more than 30 years, but the war in Ukraine has brought new worries about Russia's intentions. In addition, says Sandro Tarhan-Muravi, a social sciences professor at the University of Georgia, Russian citizens are able to enter Georgia without visas.
We don't have any kind of restrictions on who is allowed to enter Georgia. So within the Russian community in Georgia, there are all kinds of people.
Political dissidents, for sure, but others too, Tarhan Muravi says. People who've left for economic reasons, and now those who are fleeing the military call-up. There could even be spies too, says Tarhan Muravi. And regardless of why these Russians are here, some are people who look down on Georgians.
People who still carry with them somewhat chauvinist attitudes, you know, that you've been a part of Russia, you have to talk in Russian. When you have this kind of people who have this, frankly, imperialist attitude that Georgians are somehow obliged to talk in Russian, obviously, I think they are getting some deserved response.
A small number of Russians are learning Georgian, like Andrei Babitsky. Why, I ask him, when so many of his compatriots aren't?
Because I live in Georgia now. I think it's common decency.
Babitsky left Russia 20 hours after it invaded Ukraine. In Georgia, he says studying the language is like working out in the gym. Do it regularly and you'll see improvement. He says he's no smarter than any of the other Russians here. It's just that they can't be bothered.
I know for sure that it's for lack of trying. It's not for, you know, lack of skills.
Babitsky's newfound mastery of Georgian has started paying off.
Because everybody loves me here. I'm like this only guy, Russian guy who tries speaking Georgian. Everybody loves me.
It's never been easier, he says, to get a taxi or book a table at a popular restaurant. He's trying to convince other Russians of these advantages, but so far, he says, the message isn't getting through. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, Tbilisi, Georgia.
Denmark will soon lose some princes and a princess. Four of the Danish queen's grandchildren will be referred to as either count or countess starting next year. The official reason given by Queen Margrethe II is to allow her grandchildren to shape their own existence. Joining us now is historian Lars Hobacke Sørensen. He's an associate professor at University College Albertslund in Denmark. Lars, we've heard the official line from the queen, but what sparked this change?
I think there are two different explanations. One is the one which the queen actually is giving, namely that she wants to give more freedom to her grandchildren. And that is only possible if they should not have a lot of official duties as members of the royal house. Another thing, another aspect for this decision is that the queen wants to modernize the monarchy by making the royal house smaller, so to speak. It means with fewer persons in it, so that you could keep the very large public support among the population for the monarchy.
King Charles in the UK is reportedly also interested in slimming down the House of Windsor. So is this a trend in Europe? Monarchies trying to, you know, reduce their size to basically survive?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a general European trend. You have had different models in different states. For instance, in Sweden, they took a decision in 2019 the persons kept their titles as prince and princesses, but at the same time, they lost their economic support from the state, and they also lost the official status of being member of the royal house. They are still a member of the royal family, but they are not official working members of the royal house, and that's the difference here. So in many different European states, also in Norway, you have seen this this tendency to slim down the royal house.
So are these soon-to-be former princes and princess feeling mad about this? Are they miffed?
Well, there have been some disagreements, it seems, within the royal family. And those princes and the princes who are losing their titles now, they are actually very dissatisfied with it, it seems. And also their parents are very much dissatisfied with it. And therefore, we have had a public discussion in the medias about this, where members of the royal family have criticized the queen for her decision. And that's quite unusual. We have never had such discussion in the public space before in Denmark. You have seen it in the UK, as you many people will know. Harry and Meghan has said a lot of things about the royal house, but we have never seen that in Denmark before. But this is one of the consequences of the queen's decision, which we have seen in the latest days.
So these are four grandchildren of the queen's whose titles are changing. The queen has four other grandkids. Are they keeping their titles?
Yeah, until now they are, but maybe it will change in some years.
So this announcement from the palace comes just weeks after the death of Queen Elizabeth II in the UK, which has, you know, reignited conversations about the future of that monarchy. How popular is the monarchy in Denmark?
Actually, the monarchy in Denmark is one of the most popular monarchies in Europe at all. Around 80% of the population support the monarchy as a state form, and only 13%, according to opinion polls, prefer a republic. And this has been the situation during the last more than 30 years, since around 1990. And that's quite unusual also compared with other European countries, where it have changed much more during time in the UK, in Norway, in Sweden, and so on and so forth.
So she's trying to retain that popularity rather than kind of reclaim it, I suppose.
Exactly.
Lars Hobeke Sørensen is an associate professor at University College Albison. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
The common loon is an icon of the North American wilderness. The water bird has sleek black and white feathers and a graceful dive. But the loon is in jeopardy across parts of North America, and it will take a cross-border collaboration between the U.S. and Canada to find out why. Reporter Emily Havik begins her story on the water in Ontario.
Noreen Dirtinger captured this scene in May 2019. It's a battle between two common loons on Kennebec Lake, 2 hours from Ottawa. It's not a sight that your average kayaker is likely to see. But when you're out there every day, your odds go up.
I've never really seen them get scared of me. They really let me watch.
Dirtinger is one of thousands of volunteers who have gathered data for the Canadian Lakes Loon Survey for the past 40 years.
So I record whether I saw a single loon or a loon pair, and then I also recorded the fact that I did not see any loon chicks this year.
In her first 8 years on Lake Kennebec, Dirtinger never saw a single loon chick. Then in 2010, one finally hatched.
It had a bit of a sad ending.
That summer, the chick caught a fishing lure in its beak. Dirtinger and her neighbors tried to save it, but they believe it died.
Pretty sad, considering that it was, you know, the very first one that we knew about.
Dirtinger wasn't the only volunteer who noticed the lack of chicks. So in 2019, researchers at Birds Canada stopped to analyze all four decades of data. And they found a major decline in loon chicks. But they weren't the only ones.
I'm Walter Piper, and I am a biologist at Chapman University in Orange, California.
Piper is also a scientist at the National Loon Center. For 30 years, he's monitored loons in Wisconsin. And in 2019, he also sat down and crunched the numbers.
And that's when all of these dramatic patterns dropped out.
Loons were having fewer chicks. The chicks were getting smaller and less likely to survive. And most surprising, young, non-breeding adults were declining dramatically.
I was stunned, and still am kind of stunned and shocked, because you don't expect your study animal to suddenly begin to vanish.
For Piper and the researchers in Canada, each study confirmed the validity of the other. And now they're sharing data and forming working groups as they try to figure out the cause.
There's so many possibilities.
Piper's newest unpublished data suggests heavier rains are reducing water clarity, making it harder for loons to hunt. The rain also boosts blackfly populations, which drive parents off their nests. In Canada, acid rain and mercury in the water appear to be driving factors. All of these issues are caused or aggravated by climate change, a threat that knows no borders. So researchers in Canada and the U.S. believe collaboration is key.
Oh, look at it. It's flapping its wings. That's a nice wing stretch.
Across the border, another volunteer is watching over the loons in her part of the world.
They're amazing to watch. It's actually really relaxing.
Jody Eberhardt is a volunteer supporting the National Loon Center in Minnesota. And she also collects data from her own lake, Lake Ossawinamakee.
That lake has 5 pair. So those pair I watch every day from our dock.
Eberhardt's lake is part of a new study by Piper to see if Minnesota faces the same declines as Wisconsin and Canada.
I spent a lot of time this spring watching the loon chick grow up in our bay on Ossie. And it's just neat to see them go from being little and protected by the parents and to watch them go through the whole season to be on their own and independent and get ready to take off.
But it's after they take off where the biggest mystery still lies.
What is it that is killing these young 2 to 5 year old adults?
The strong, healthy juveniles leave home in the winter and head to the Gulf of Mexico until they're ready to breed. But most of them aren't coming back, and there's no data on why.
It's a complete black hole.
In fact, the only clues have come from citizen scientists down in Florida.
You know, every once in a while, somebody walking along the beach in Tampa will find one of our loons that's washed up on shore, and someone will happen to jump on the phone and give us a call.
But it's not nearly enough data to solve the mystery. So the next step is to extend the scientific collaboration to Florida. And with those long stretches of coastline to cover, volunteers could be more crucial than ever. Birds Canada and the National Loon Center are trying to recruit more people like Jody Eberhardt on her dock in Minnesota and Noreen Dirtinger in her kayak in Canada.
The lakes and the rivers would just not be the same without the loons.
But as long as people with a passion for the loons continue to watch over them, Dirtinger is hopeful there will still be loons to watch. For The World, I'm Emily Havik.
Now, another story out of Canada, this one with implications for green energy. This Canadian story starts with a British company that supplies some 12% of the UK's renewable energy.
Hello, everyone. My name is Will Gardner, and I am the CEO of the Drax Group. Drax Power Station in Selby, North Yorkshire, is the UK's largest power station and Europe's largest decarbonisation project.
The company, Drax, has converted a power plant in Yorkshire from running on coal to burning wood.
So these are the wood pellets, and they are made from the low-grade wood, so it's dried and powdered, and then it's pressed into the pellets.
A tour guide at the Drax power station told The World back in 2018 how those pellets were made. Drax says wood scraps, sawdust, and waste wood that would otherwise go unused are compressed into pellets. When burned, they say the carbon released into the atmosphere is absorbed again by newly planted trees. European Union regulators classify energy derived from burning wood as renewable, but many scientists and conservationists argue a green label is misguided. Carbon emitted from burning wood can't all be recaptured by new trees fast enough to help the fight against climate change, they argue. Now, a BBC investigation contends that Drax isn't just burning waste wood, but trees from old-growth forests in western Canada. Journalist Joe Crowley challenged a Drax spokesperson on camera, saying his company was clear-cutting primary forest.
We're not logging primary forest.
You are, because you bid for the license to log the primary forest, you won the license to log the primary forest, you cut down the primary forest, and then you paid the wood duties on the primary forest you'd cut down.
Well, the important thing is that we didn't use that material. Material from that area went to sawmills to make lumber.
The BBC claims that's not true. Reporter Joe Crowley told us today how he trailed a lumber truck from an old-growth forest straight to a Drax pellet plant in Canada.
And so here we had very, very good first-hand evidence. I've seen it with my own eyes that Drax is taking tree trunks, whole trees, as they would say, from primary forest in British Columbia and turning them into pellets.
Drax, in a statement today, maintained that it uses only sawmill residues and waste wood from Canadian forests for its wood pellets. The results of the BBC investigation are being shown to UK viewers tonight on the investigative program Panorama. That's the world today. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime on our homepage right now. The stunning diversity of electric vehicles in China. They come in all shapes and sizes. Those photos are at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for listening.